You're listening to The Bulletin with UBS, first broadcast on the 28th of December 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24. Each week we're hearing from the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance, taking you beyond the numbers and the hype and getting to the heart of the big issues of the day. This week we're looking back at 2014 and taking stock of some of the stories that have shaped the last 12 months. Whether it's political instability in Ukraine, triple dip in the Eurozone, or tumbling oil prices, we'll consider the lasting impact of the major events of the past year. We start with Russia, where the story was Vladimir Putin's continued incursion into Ukraine and the ripples that this hostility and the ongoing efforts of the rest of the world to stop it have had around the globe. Peter Hobson is the business editor at the Moscow Times. What does he think we learned about Putin and about Russia this year?
Emerging markets are incredibly vulnerable to outflows and inflows of capital. And so we've seen that all year, that huge quantities of money have been leaving Russia, and that's been incredibly destabilizing. Another thing is where informational systems and political systems are different from the ones that we're used to in the West, populations will accept completely different outcomes. And so the Russian people have shown that they will accept quite large degrees of hardship and inconvenience for the sake of Crimea and for the sake of being right in Ukraine. That I don't think that we really reckon with that fact in the West. And one other thing I would say is that looking back on the year, is that the West has used its clout in a way that may backfire, I think. Russia has made a lot of efforts this year to diversify, to rid itself of dependence on the West in all sorts of areas, and to encourage other people to do so as well. And so we're seeing de-dollarization slowly but surely. We're seeing financial services, things like SWIFT and payment systems, Russia making concerted efforts to build them up. And I think that the West, it has a very strong hand now, but by playing it, it's weakening that hand in the future. And I think we might look back at this year as an important one in terms of that.
So was the West wrong-footed by Vladimir Putin?
People got complacent in that borders are secure and everybody adheres to a basic sort of vision of civilizational progress and progress of humanity in economic and political senses. And Putin demonstrated that no, such complacency can't be. And I think that shocks a lot of people, not only in the West, but actually here also.
Brian Whitmore is a senior editor for Radio Free Europe, for which he hosts Power Vertical about Russian politics. He thinks Vladimir Putin has definitively lost his magician's touch in 2014.
In the past, Putin's looked like something of a magician. When he needed oil prices to go up, they went up. When he needed the economy to stabilize, it stabilized. When he wanted to invade one of his neighbors, like he did with Georgia in 2008, he did so with little consequences. But what we're seeing with this crisis is that Putin's not really the magician we thought he was. What he's been is a very lucky man, and now his luck is running out. The fundamentals don't look very good. Russia's economy is dangerously dependent on oil. The long-term trend is down. Russia's economy needs to diversify, and it would diversify in a couple of years' time. He didn't explain how. We've been hearing this thing about diversifying the economy away from energy for years now, but it never happens. And there's a reason it never happens, because if Mr. Putin were to truly embark on a program to diversify the economy, and that is create other centers of economic power outside the energy sector, that would, by definition, lead to more economic pluralism. And if you have economic pluralism, sooner or later, you're going to have political pluralism. And this is completely unacceptable to the current elite, of course, political pluralism. So this is a paradox. Russia's economy needs diversification. The political system can't tolerate it. The economics is, in a sense, hostage to the politics. So the things that Putin can do to truly help the economy, he can't or won't do. And this is, I think, very much at the root of the problem. And until Mr. Putin does that, the Russian economy is going to be a hostage to oil prices, and the long-term trend is expected to be down.
Brian Whitmore there, talking Russia and Vladimir Putin, never out of the headlines for long in 2014. The instability in eastern Ukraine and the associated uncertainty flowing from Moscow was probably felt most keenly anywhere in the world, in Europe. It was certainly one of the defining events when it came to shaping the Eurozone and when it came to challenges facing the ECB. Reinhard Kluse, chief European economist at UBS Investment Bank based in London, shares his views on the year just gone. How did 2014 measure up to his initial expectations? And was Ukraine, as we've been hearing, the decisive factor?
If we compare the outcome of 2014 with our initial expectation, it has been a lot more challenging than we expected. And I think this had a lot to do with the events in Ukraine. So that has been, I think, a dark shadow on the business cycle outlook, particularly in the core of Europe, in Germany. The shadow is still there, but I mean, we nevertheless expect that the economic outlook for 2015 and 16 should improve compared with 2014. More specifically, we believe that GDP growth in the Eurozone will pick up from 0.8% in 2014 to 1.2% in 2015 and 1.6% in 2016. Now, you might ask, why should growth pick up, given all the challenges that we're facing in Russia and Ukraine and, you know, elections in Greece? But there are, in fact, a number of important growth drivers. The first one is the expected improvement in U.S. growth. The second one is very accommodative monetary policy by the ECB, combined with now a much weaker euro exchange rate. The third one is the moderation in fiscal austerity in Europe. And the final one I would mention is very low inflation and now the sharp decline in oil prices, which is supporting consumer expenditure. So all of these combined should mean that perhaps not so much in the early part of 2015, but over the course of 2015 and into 2016, growth in the Eurozone should pick up again somewhat.
And how does Reinhard Kluse think the ECB has performed?
Surely the events have forced the ECB to greatly increase the degree of monetary accommodation. And this has not been easy. Why? Because the ECB makes monetary policy for 18 countries, and the decisions are not easy. They are not as easy as the US monetary policy or in the UK or in Japan. The ECB has to perform a one-size-fits-all monetary policy, and that also implies that not everyone who sits at the table agrees with the strategy. And that means that overall, perhaps, the performance of the ECB was more reactive than proactive. But in the end, I think the ECB has done a good job in loosening its monetary policy and then also preparing the ground for the next monetary policy steps that are likely to occur in the first half, or in fact, the first quarter of 2015, which is likely to be the purchase of sovereign bonds.
Reinhard Kluse, Chief European Economist at UBS Investment Bank, considering 2014 for the Eurozone. Still to come on the Bulletin with UBS, we'll look in more detail at the market volatility that shaped the year just gone. Stay with us. . 2014 was a year in which we saw some volatile market moves, some potholes in the road, if you will, the causes of which can at times seem pretty unclear. Kiran Ganesh, cross-asset strategist at UBS, explains what we saw and why we saw it.
2014 did see quite a number of fairly remarkable moves in response to relatively little news. I mean, we've just seen the Norwegian krona decline by more than 6%, which is a huge move for a currency. And it did that in just a matter of hours, and it bounced all the way back. And then we can remember back in October, we saw that retail sales, which are normally relatively low profile, led treasury yields down by around 33% in a day. Based on normal behavior, that should normally occur only once every 1.6 billion years. So we've seen a number of pretty remarkable kind of potholes in the market this year. And, you know, the causes of these still remains fairly unclear.
Given that uncertainty, then, how to negotiate the best path forward? What should the experiences of the past 12 months impress upon people most urgently?
I think what it does is it makes it very important, you know, firstly to remain well diversified across, you know, different asset classes so you're not exposed to any one particular large move like this. And I think the second thing is that investors need to be, I guess, increasingly think long term and be very aware of they have, whether it's structured products or positions which kind of stop out in the events of large moves or positions held on margin. Anything which stops out in the event of a large move is more vulnerable, it would seem, than it used to be. So people do need to remain, as a well diversified and keep a relatively long-term approach and possibly a less leveraged approach when they're investing.
But why does this happen? Is it sometimes simply impossible to foresee?
The usual reason that is ascribed is when there are investors, whether it's hedge funds or other private investors, who are holding leveraged positions in markets which are maybe not as liquid as people expect them to be. And then when you do start to see a fall, which is perhaps initially fundamentally justified, but then once it starts to hit some of these positions where the market isn't particularly liquid and where there's a fixed point at which investors have to close those positions, then you can end up with a sort of a negative spiral which leads to these very, very sharp moves away from fundamentals. I mean, that seems to be what happened in the case of Treasuries earlier in the year. As I said, more recently in the case of the Norwegian kroner. Again, it's not clear what happened, but it does seem to be that may have been the case.
Bob Swarup, the financial commentator and investor and author of Money Mania, was struck by two themes regarding the flash correction this year.
One was, I think, how little attention people paid to it. I mean, there was a few stories in the financial press about it. Didn't really hit the main pages. Unlike, by the way, the flash crash that happened in stock markets, if you remember, a couple of years earlier. I think actually it could potentially be a canary in the coal mine, because the Treasuries is the biggest, most liquid market in the world. So to get a correction of that magnitude means you had a huge liquidity squeeze. To get a liquidity squeeze in the biggest market in the world is a pretty scary thing. I know that when I talked to people at the day when it happened, the immediate aftermath, there were a lot of people in the industry who were spooked by it. I mean, one of them told me it was a 7-standard deviation event, you know, which sounds suspicious, like language I used to hear back in 2008. You know, I remember being on a call with a nameless investment bank who told me that on the Tuesday they had a 1-in-10,000-year correction, and then it happened again on Thursday, which, you know, told you perhaps more about where they were and where the markets were than anything else. I think that is quite scary to me, because you can see also that one of the unintended consequences of QE has been that QE actually has sucked a lot of the liquid collateral, i.e. gilts, treasuries, and so on, out of the system. And so I think the flash crash may well be part of the consequences of that. And when you think about the fact that many institutions, not just banks, by the way, or financial players, but, you know, pension funds, insurance companies, all these people are now indulging more and more in derivatives one way or the other to hedge their interest rate risk, inflation risk, and so on. You have a problem where all these derivatives are ultimately being backed by some form of collateral. That collateral usually is government bonds. And if that has a liquidity squeeze, I mean, that could be extremely painful in a much worse, more systemic way.
The next theme to delve into that preoccupied many, especially later in the year just gone, was oil, or more specifically, the price of it. First question, who were the real winners from the tumbling price? Here's Bob Swarup again.
The biggest way oil always benefits growth, it actually puts more money in people's pockets. So, you know, if you're a consumer, I mean, let's face it, you know, I drive a car all the time, and I'm very, very sensitive to, you know, 139p, 127p, whatever it may be. The less it is, I think what's interesting actually is, you know, bear in mind, I mean, let's take a tank of petrol, right? 140p a litre down to, let's say, 125p a litre. If I put in 50 litres, I'm only saving 7.50. It's not exactly, you know, a huge amount of money I'm saving. On the other hand, I think, firstly, all those bits add up. And particularly for people, you know, who tend to travel a lot, that becomes extra money in the pocket. But I think also there's the psychological impact. The very fact that you feel prices are falling, this is good deflation. You know, we're always obsessed about bad deflation. This is good deflation. This is the bit, you know, when China, for example, is driving the prices of technology down, or manufactured goods, or Tesco's having their price cut wars in supermarkets. These things psychologically make us feel we have more disposable income. That's pretty important when you consider that at the moment, wage growth in the UK, in the US, most of the developed world is pretty non-existent. You know, you've had this kind of classic falling pattern now for 30 years. And people do feel under siege. You know, there was that fascinating survey that showed that actually the vast majority of Britons do not feel the recovery's benefited them. It's fascinating. You know, 6 years on from a financial crisis, and there is still a siege mentality. So from that point of view, the falling oil probably is a good thing. The bad thing, as I said, is that there's a danger that it has, you know, unintended consequences on the geopolitical front.
Talking about geopolitics, what about OPEC? The organisation elected not to cut production at its much-anticipated November meeting. Some analysts suggested the organisation itself was becoming increasingly marginalised and that certain factors, such as US shale production, are hastening that process. Is that a fair reflection on the sector for the year just gone? It's all a question of circumstances, says UBS sector strategist Nicole Decker.
You know, I can't speak to the importance of OPEC. I think the circumstances today are rather unique. I think for the first time in history, we're seeing a couple of things. First of all, OPEC is relatively disadvantaged from an economic standpoint because the price that they need to balance, many countries need to balance their fiscal budgets, is higher than the break-even cost of production for some other operators around the world, including the U.S. shale. The other thing that I think is different is that U.S. shale production is relatively short term, and so that production and supply can be altered relatively quickly. And so I think that, you know, historically OPEC has been, you know, advantaged from both of these standpoints. That is no longer the case, and I would argue that OPEC kind of has a long-term problem on its hands.
The view there of Nicole Decker looking back at oil in 2014. And that brings us to the end of this 12th edition of the Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24, where we were looking back over an extraordinary year in the fast-moving world of finance. Listen again and find out more at monocle.com or tune in via iTunes or SoundCloud. On next week's programme, we'll be looking ahead to 2015 and considering some of the surprises that may lie in store. The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24.